Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who's got uncommon intelligence, in my estimation, and who shares it with us frequently, I'm pleased to say, is with us today. Her name is Jessica Vaughn. She is the Director of Policy Studies for the simply indispensable Center for Immigration Studies. She's a former Foreign Service officer, having served in Belgium and in the Caribbean, Trinidad and Tobago, during her time in the State Department. She's now one of the great resources for this program, and I think for our country, on matters involving immigration policy and related subjects. And I'm very pleased to have her with us. Jessica, as always, thanks so much for taking a few minutes. I want to talk about a subject that's a little bit out of area, but you're all about things coming to this country from elsewhere that can be problematic, usually of the humankind. But I wanted to ask you, Jessica, there's a report that is out in the news today about a very alarming seizure of a large amount of components for what are described as assault weapons, some 10,800 component parts to be precise, that were picked up by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection team in Louisville, Kentucky, at a place called the Express Consignment Operation Hub. These components of almost 11,000 assault weapons were apparently destined for a private residence in Melbourne, Florida, having been shipped there from Shenzhen, China. We'll be talking later in the program about problems with the Chinese Communist Party with Dr. Michael Pillsbury, but I just wanted to get your sort of assessment of this situation, and in particular, a concern that I immediately had, which is Melbourne's not that far from Jacksonville, Florida, where, of course, in another month and half's time, the Republican convention for the presidency of the United States and the Republican nomination for that post will be taking place. Your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I agree. This is very unnerving. The number of component parts associated with assault weapons, hats off to CBP for intercepting this. In this time of unrest, this is very troubling to hear. And, you know, you can't help but wonder who is at the address where these parts were being shipped to, and what is the purpose of this? You're right. The upcoming Republican convention in Florida is potentially a target that people would look at. There are, you know, places like Orlando that have all of the theme parks that are, you know, the amusement parks like Disney World and SeaWorld that are trying to open up again. And, you know, we're sort of just allowed now to come out and into the, you know, the public domain again. And so it's very unnerving to hear something like this. You know, of course, Florida was the site of one of the most recent terrorist attacks as well in Pensacola, with the Saudi soldiers who attacked there. And there have been other instances of people arrested in Florida who are associated with terrorism. Of course, you know, now we have the threat of domestic terrorism as well, in a time when law enforcement agencies are being forced to hold back in how they police, especially in the public square. And this, in my view, is only emboldening violent extremist groups of all kinds to plan and attempt to carry out attacks either on the public or on other targets. This is very unnerving. You know, there are so many, the threats from China exist on so many levels, whether it's shipments of contraband like this, or espionage, or corporate espionage, or other forms of infiltration into our society, that, you know, our government does not take it seriously enough. This should be yet another wake-up call to federal officials to really rethink how we deal with China and what, you know, the flow of people and goods that we allowed and how we monitor that.
Amen. And this is especially so, Jessica Vaughn, as I'm sure you're aware, that the connections between the Chinese Communist Party and some of the Marxist groups in this country, like the Freedom Road Socialist Organization and the Liberation Road, that have been prime movers behind organizations like Black Lives Matter, in fact, you know, obviously are aligned with Antifa as well. And the thought that presumably with the permission of the Chinese government, if not at its instigation, 11,000 weapons, or at least components of weapons, are being dumped into our country, perhaps in especially ominous proximity to some very important venues and events, is indeed, as you say, a wake-up call. I hope we will arouse ourselves to be properly awake and on our game about it. Let me turn to one other thing quickly before we run out of time with you, Jessica. I've been talking up two things: the president's 200th mile of border wall that has been built in his time in office, and also this immigration pause. Could you comment quickly on both of those events?
Well, it's very heartening to see this completion of another 200 miles of wall. Worth celebrating. It's going to be a great help in our national security and border security. A lot of the wall is in new places that have been exploited by criminal alien smugglers and smugglers of other contraband, whether it's drugs or weapons, cash going back and forth. The wall is going to help with that too, because it forces these the cartel-linked groups and smuggling groups into places where the Border Patrol has a better shot of being able to deal with them. The immigration pause is very helpful to national security as well, even though that hasn't been widely discussed. The main purpose of the suspension of some of the green card and temporary work visa categories has been to make sure that the scarce jobs that are available now are available first to Americans and legal immigrants who are already here, with the economic shutdown imposed because of the pandemic threat. A lot of American workers have been sidelined by this and can use these jobs. It covers both temporary and permanent jobs, skilled and less skilled. And so that's going to give really needed relief. I've estimated that the proclamations together and the promised regulatory reform could open up something like 600,000 jobs for U.S. workers that we badly need. And, you know, every time we limit the entry of people from abroad, it makes it harder for the bad actors around the world to get in as well.
Jessica Vaughn, as always, thank you very much for your time and the great work you do at the Center for Immigration Studies. Come back to us again with updates if you would. Next up, we will speak with Dinah West about the larger challenge we're facing in terms of our republic under siege. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for one of the highlights of our week here at Secure Freedom Radio, and that is our visit with the great Dinah West. Dinah is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist, now a great blogger at dinahwest.net, also the author of three incredibly important books: The Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Dinah, it's good to have you with us, even though the times certainly bear out many of your admonitions and alarms, really, in those three books, and of course in your writings at dinahwest.net. I'm glad to have you with us, though, to at least talk our way through it. I want to start with, Diana, where we are. You have, of course, chronicled how we've been getting to where we are for some time, notably in Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. But I'm interested in your thinking about what seems to be the unfolding of a plan, not just sort of chaotic things that are happening, which is, of course, true, but there does seem to be method to the madness, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on it.
Yes, well, it's a very important story that requires a lot of thought and detective work, but a lot of clues are in plain sight. And the one that really strikes me that I think is the best way into it for people just to begin thinking about it, I'm sure many of people are already thinking about it and maybe having nightmares about it, but if you go back to the much ballyhooed and frantic news around the unveiling of the new Green Deal, it seems like another era of history at this point, looking back a couple of years, to Ocasio-Cortez and the Green New Deal, and all of the apparently, at the time, we thought, ridiculous criteria for this new Green Deal to advance, or rather things that would have to be accomplished in order for the new Green Deal to advance, to become real. And one of those things that just keeps just ringing in my brain is the elimination of the airline industry, that in order to get to this point of curtailing fuel use, airlines would have to go out of business and Americans would have to stop taking planes. And people at the time thought that this made it sound like the most ridiculous, pie in the sky, absurd kind of legislation. And yet look where we are today. If you look in the news pages, every day it seems like another airline is laying off thousands of people and closing hubs and airports. There's some amazing video online people can find where there's a drone, I suppose, flying over an airfield somewhere out west where there are just stacks and stacks of passenger lines parked because no one is flying. Well, hello, Green New Deal, coronavirus, and the lockdown. So how do we get from there to here? It looks like a lot of the same players were talking about how to get us from here to there. We're implementing these things, and then along comes coronavirus, and of course one of the other big markers you might want to talk about is something called Event 201, which brought together a number of the same players we see on the sort of manning the ramparts for things like the Gates vaccine, the Fauci plan, etc. We see people from the Gates Foundation, we see people from various sectors of the health world, the foundation world, all coming together and gaming out a pandemic.
This is a fascinating story, Diana West, because, as you say, in New York City, you had this improbable cast of characters coming together in November of last year. It's all available, the videotape of it, online. So we're not, you know, wildly speculating about who came together or for what purpose. This sort of globalist slash communist Chinese tabletop exercise mapped out how global governance could be advanced, including by getting immense amounts of money sent its way as a result of a coronavirus pandemic. Now, this is a month or so before one was unleashed, it appears, either deliberately or inadvertently, and then deliberately moved along by the Chinese Communist Party. So, Diana, I mean, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to say, wait a minute, you know, you had people who have prominently now exploited all of this, including for the benefit of, you know, building up world governance and shutting down business in this country and Green New Deal enforcement and the like, to say, is that in fact what we are being subjected to is kind of a planned takedown of our country?
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, 100% yes. And we can watch the future being mapped out as well, because, you know, as we've gone through these various periods of buzzwords, you know, going from, you know, flatten the curve to ventilators to lockdown to, you know, the various, we're now, our latest buzzword we're starting to get in the last week or two is something called the Great Reset, which is supposed to be a global capitalistic reset of our completely destroyed economies by the World Economic Forum. I mean, this is just so prevalent and so blatant. They're already planning their next gathering to actually nail this down. But apparently there was quite a gathering earlier in June where some of this was mapped out, and then you start getting this kind of narrative kind of setting the table for the next lockstep, the next lockstep kind of plan being implemented. It's so sinister, and yet it just kind of goes forward as we're all tremendously and understandably distracted by all of the violence and the unrest and the coming apart at the seams of the country itself.
Which, of course, brings us to another point, which is that some of the people that are bringing us that distracting violence and mayhem in our streets and so on are, of course, working with the Chinese Communist Party, have for many years in some cases, certainly benefiting from, you know, the Marxist organizational footprint in the United States. And otherwise, you know, it seems advancing further this idea that everything has to be conforming to the hard left's diktat, lest one be called a racist or whatever else, you will conform. And not only that, you will help underwrite it if you're a major American corporation. You know? So this brings us to the question Tucker Carlson has been wrestling with manfully, I have to say. I think he's a remarkable patriot and incredible champion for freedom in our country. And we don't agree on absolutely everything, of course, neither do most of us on most things. But on this central issue, Diana West, Tucker has been very clear and very vocal that where is our leadership? Where are the forces that we rely upon to protect us from this kind of leftist takeover, this diminution of our freedoms, to say nothing of our sovereignty and, you know, our republic? And his answer is, well, it's the Republican Party that is, you know, the only game in town, basically. And then he's pretty harshly critical of their performance to date. What are your thoughts about who's needed now and where they are?
Well, it is a matter of, you know, are the lights are on, is anybody home? This is a vacuum of Republican leadership. Nobody making the case for the country. I mean, the most we get are sort of discussions of things that are against the law. But in terms of this is one of Tucker's themes, as a matter of fact, that this is a good country, this is a country worth protecting, that we are good people. We're not hearing that message whatsoever. I mean, it's part of the general, you know, in terms of nobody should be terribly surprised in that we're all creatures of our time, and these Republicans in office are subject to the same brainwashing and social justice warrior making that our entire education and cultural and political system have been making for decades.
What you've described, Diana West, is the institutional sort of infrastructure of our country that has been marched through by the cultural Marxists. And you have been documenting this brilliantly now for years. So to bring it all together, I think this brings us back to where we often wind up, which is the importance of Donald Trump's leadership, because he has, of course, been elected president of the United States, I think with very much this kind of apprehension in mind, the need for, you know, a new direction in the Republican Party, and certainly a systemic course correction in terms of our fidelity to our country and our standing up for it in the face of this globalist slash communist effort to take it down.
Yes, well, I agree, and he is that man to do that. He is in a very difficult position. I will say I do give him a lot of slack in these matters. He's not just a normal president with 100% powers and a cabinet and departments, including the Justice Department, FBI, etc., at his beck and call, the way a strongly supported president is. He is president in the swamp, and he is currently trying to maneuver very harsh or difficult snake-infested waters to get from here to Election Day. I will be very interested to see his speech on July 3rd out at Mount Rushmore, which the Democrats tweeted was going to be a white supremacy rally. I mean, they took the tweet down, but this is how they actually look at a celebration of the 4th of July at Mount Rushmore. It's absolutely staggering. So this, you know, I suspect he will be laying down the same markers that we want to see as he goes forward, but it is very difficult. I don't know how he actually gets up every day and does this job, given the war on him that is waged as the war on the country is waged, which ultimately is a war on him and the people who put him in office, Americans.
Make no mistake about it, folks. This is about the election. Black Lives Matter says it's about the election. The other radical left Democrats and so on make it very clear it's about the election. If we want to save our country, we are going to have to come to grips with the various threats that are trying to take it down and the need for real leadership in opposition to it. Dinah West, you provide some of that leadership, certainly with your excellent blog, dinahwest.net. Check it out and her terrific books. Dinah, thank you. Next up, we'll visit with Dr. Michael Pillsbury, an advisor to President Trump on China, about the threat it poses to us and what we best be doing about it. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by, well, a man I've known for a long time, an exotic creature in the zoology of Washington, D.C., I think it's fair to say, a subject matter expert, a highly regarded historian, a prolific author, a, well, almost incessantly interviewed individual on matters involving most especially Communist China and the Chinese Communist Party that runs it. His name is Dr. Michael Pillsbury. He is the director of the Center for China Strategy at the Hudson Institute and the author of The 100-Year Marathon and a subject matter expert who has been known to be valued by President Trump on some of the most important topics of our time, which I consider to be the existential threat to freedom posed by that Chinese Communist Party, also known as CCP. Dr. Pillsbury, it's good to have you in the house virtually. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about this environment, this challenging, interesting times, I think is the term for the Chinese, you know, rhetorical model, isn't it? Let's talk about a little of what's preceded it, Michael, because in the 100-Year Marathon in particular, you have drawn some important insights for our time from what's known as the Warring States period in Chinese history. Just remind us quickly what that period was and what, I think you had 9 different techniques or, you know, sort of strategies that the Chinese have taken from that time and are employing, it seems, quite effectively at the moment.
Well, the Warring States period is sort of the foundational or even philosophical period of Chinese history when Confucius lived and Sun Tzu, The Art of War, was written. It's essentially a period of several hundred years when different small states within China competed to see who would be the hegemon and who would take over the known world. And the techniques of competition during the Warring States period is a subject for many proverbs, and today in China it's the topic of many movies. Chairman Mao, when he was leading the Long March, took along a history of the Warring States period with him. It's the only book he really took with him. So this is the foundation of Chinese strategy and Chinese culture, as well as how to deal with other countries. So today, the Chinese strategic community discusses what lessons they can learn from the Warring States period, their classic period of their entire history, that they can apply to the competition with the United States. And they're sometimes quite explicit about this in various books. The two guys who wrote Unrestricted Warfare about 20 years ago, I go see them periodically in China. They produced a second book on the new Warring States era, and they explicitly use lessons from the Warring States. It hasn't been translated into English, unfortunately, and I use it in part in 100-Year Marathon to describe the strategic thought the Chinese have.
And let's characterize it a little bit more precisely. It seems to me of these 9, and we don't have time to go through all of them probably in detail, but The things that jump out at me are deception, patience, being alive to being deceived yourself, being concerned about a hegemon fighting back if you're threatening it, and trying to essentially disable that hegemon, which then ties in nicely, really, with some of the techniques of unrestricted warfare as well. So how would you characterize the extent to which that's basically what we're dealing with now in the Chinese Communist Party of today?
I think it's very close to what they're trying to do. The idea of inducing complacency in America is quite important, and they work through. We can see in their foreign influence operations that the FBI has been surveilling and reporting about. They try to stress that China is not a threat, it's a friend to America, that China has very similar values, that they pick out a number of people, and they prefer billionaires, frankly. They now have more billionaires than we do, but they still pick out our billionaires, invite them to China to meet with their leadership, and they have a set of talking points that they convey, whether it's through FM radio shows in our country or Chinese TV shows in English.
Inserts in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and Washington Post and the like, yeah.
Very much so. It's that we don't want a cold... Here's some of the themes that they've used in the past year. A cold war with China would be very foolish for Americans to start for two reasons. America would lose, and China is so strong, it wouldn't even react or notice sort of cold war tactics. A second one is that there are people in America, especially in Washington, D.C., who are retrograde sort of monsters who are trying to start a new Cold War. And these people have no basis for what they're doing. They are irresponsible warmongers. There's a lot of specific attacks on individual American public figures for starting a Cold War with China. And there's a list of what these people are trying to do and how friends of China have to fight against this corruption that's going on. One of their favorite targets is Steve Bannon. Even after Steve was fired by the president and kind of demonized, the Chinese elevated him even higher. They brought him to China to meet with their vice president, and they consistently talk about Steve Bannon as the true American strategy toward China, that the friends of China must fight against Steve Bannon. This is one of their rallying cries. And this happened in their warring states. They would pick out individual advisors to the hegemon, and they would demonize that advisor. So this is their attacks on Steve Bannon are right out of 2,500 years ago.
Steve, of course, is a longtime friend of mine, and as you know, one of the members of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. So we're familiar with both the vilification of Steve as well as some of their own characterizations, I think, of our efforts as retrograde. But Michael, to the extent that we're talking about influence operations and billionaires, I mean, it is somewhat cheeky of them to say that, you know, those of us in the retrograde camp, the cold warrior types, or the people opposed to the Chinese Communist Party are the ones who are corrupt. When you look at the people that they've brought to their team, the engagement folks, some of whom are, you know, renowned elder statesmen like Henry Kissinger and Hank Paulson and so on. And Larry Fink, by the way, I would throw into this mix. The corruption of those individuals seems to be pretty palpable. And you captured this the other day, interestingly, in an interview you had with Maria Bartiromo, in which you responded to a question that she put to you about some policy issue at the moment. I think it was the thrift savings plan one, if I'm not mistaken, that the Chinese are laughing at us, you said. And partly, I think you said that's because they've seen how corrupt we are and how easily manipulated we can be. Give us that backstory a little bit, if you would.
I think the Chinese belief is that a real Cold War policy by America would be devastating to them. They would be denied advanced technology, a lot of capital, perhaps even most capital that we now provide would be cut off. We would organize a sort of NATO-type coalition of all their neighbors. We would develop weapon systems to counter them in space and in cyber. They've got there's books I've obtained in Beijing where they lay out this nightmare for what the Americans could do to them.
And then they tend to compare that extreme nightmare with what is actually happening. So things like the Thrift Supervisory Board issue, and of course Larry Fink was the one who gave the briefing in November, proposing just how this would work. It's in the minutes that are online of the board meeting. If you look at the minutes of the Thrift Supervisory Board, you will see the proposal initiative to have the so-called iFund invest in Chinese companies. That was presented to the board by Larry Fink himself in an in-person briefing. So you see how this works? They're comparing, so in other words, they're comparing a real Cold War where, let's say, Steve Bannon got all of his wishes were implemented, and China was essentially brought to its knees unless it would reform its Communist Party policies. They compare that to what has really been happening to them over the last 10 years or so. And what they see basically is pinpricks, really small-scale actions. The continuity of our largest embassy in the world remains in Beijing, 2,300 officials. 50 agencies are there with various kinds of assistance programs to China. I call a 100-year marathon, Frank, at the end, just to have an inventory of all these programs that we run to help, with the federal government runs to help China. That's been strongly resisted. People who believe in the relationship don't want those programs exposed.
Well, witness what's been going on with the NIH and the CDC and the FDA recently.
Right. There was a huge shock when people found out that Tony Fauci knows people in Beijing and Wuhan. So a pinprick to them often follows a sort of a huge debate here where we don't really do that much against China. This is what I'm trying to convey in 100-year marathon, that they are ahead in the marathon. They believe they got about 35 years to go. They believe they're way ahead of schedule, that they could in fact surpass us within the next few years. President Trump has also said this several times, that if he weren't president, China would be surpassing us now. President Trump does not seem to believe in the China collapse theory.
He does not, or the peaceful rise theory, I think, either. And I trust you don't either. Michael, we have to take a brief break. We'll be right back with more, with the author of a 100-year marathon. And we'll talk a bit about a very important present policy choice that may be considerably more than a pinprick if it's adopted. That and much more with Michael Pillsbury of the Hudson Institute, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting in this segment, as well as the previous one, with Dr. Michael Pillsbury. He is an informal advisor to President Trump, but formally he is the director of the Center for China Strategy at the Hudson Institute. He has been in and out of government a lot over the years on Capitol Hill, as well as in the executive branch, notably at the Defense Department. And he has been a very informed observer and analyst of what the Chinese Communist Party is up to, notably in his masterwork, The 100-Year Marathon. Let me ask you about a present policy choice, Michael Pillsbury. As you know, in the past week, the Department of Defense, in which you and I both served, actually came forth 21 years after it was ordered to do so by statute and revealed 20 in what they called the first tranche of so-called Communist Chinese military companies, I say for shorthand, People's Liberation Army, PLA companies, that are operating in, either directly or indirectly, the United States. And this, it seems to me, is both a national security problem of the first order as well as a potential opportunity for President Trump. Talk about these companies, what you know of them, what, if anything, this revelation may say to you about the degree to which they're deeply inside our wire.
Well, they are inside our wire, and I think what the 100-year marathon argument was, to put all this in context, Frank, is we have to use the word the Chinese use. They call it national champions. These are largely subsidized companies whose stature 20 years ago, when the Congress first demanded this list, these companies were probably quite small then. In the year 2000, China had zero of its corporations on the Fortune 500 list of the biggest capitalization companies in the world. Now China has surpassed us. They have about 129, 130 Chinese corporations on the Fortune 500 list, whereas we're about 110 or so. This is really stunning when you think about it. In a 20-year period, to see the largest corporations in the world, and I might say the most profitable, be in China, not in America. This is just quite astonishing over a 20-year shift. So the time when Congress was demanding this list of companies that through the Civil Military Fusion Program have to help the Chinese military, at that point, these were insignificant companies. Now they're among the largest in the world. And what is essentially happening, these companies have operations inside the United States. They've been on American infrastructure projects, for example. And the national champions has become the main strategy identified with Xi Jinping. It is recipe for, if you want to be melodramatic, taking over the world without firing a shot right out of Sun Tzu Art of War.
It may be melodramatic, but it is his plan. Let's be clear.
Well, it's the topic of the 100-year marathon. It's exactly how they zeroed in the early 80s. They got some Nobel Prize winners in economics, including Friedman himself. They had a team work together with them in the World Bank, and they created this plan to have national champions because they were told correctly no country in the world had ever had a growth rate above 6% and tried to surpass the hegemon, the Americans. So they crafted this plan in the early 80s. The World Bank provided them the largest amount of loans of any country in the world. The World Bank set up a very large office of 3,000 experts in Beijing. With the help of our own Nobel Prize winners in economics, they crafted this state-owned strategy. Yes, Friedman himself went twice and has written about it. They added on later the idea of stealing technology and intellectual property. The World Bank claims that it never told China to do that. But once these state-owned enterprises could receive stolen intellectual property from Chinese government intelligence services, they added another part of the recipe that they would, in fact, surpass the Americans, but they would do it in this strange hybrid kind of economic warfare, while all the time not only having our billionaires serve as their spokesman, but also inducing complacency in whatever means possible.
Michael, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk about. You've, I think, brought us back to those sort of nine strategies of the Warring States era. And let me just ask you about a countervailing strategy on our part. This is a moment when, as you well know, China is on the march, crushing the people of Hong Kong and their aspiration for freedom. They have these companies in our country that are stealing our technology, stealing our intellectual property, probably doing other things in terms of espionage and subversion as well, I reckon, because that's what they do pursuant to the national intelligence law, even if they're not PLA companies. But Michael Pillsbury, let me just ask you, the President of the United States needs to respond, it seems to me, to what China is now doing in a way that's more meaningful, that isn't a pinprick, that isn't just, you know, Magnitsky Act sort of sanctions on the perpetrators of various terrible things in Hong Kong, but something material and that will be both punitive to the Chinese Communist Party and also helpful to us in our national security. It seems to the Committee on the Present Danger of China, which has written the president, as you know, a letter to this effect, that this is a moment for the president to shut down these Chinese Communist Party, PLA companies doing business inside the United States and cut off their access to these capital markets. Now, there'll be people inside the president's inner circle who will hate that idea, but I ask you, you've signed this letter, thankfully. Does this not seem to be a moment when, for our vital interests, as well as an important signal of where we stand in trying to defend the free world, a piece of which has just been lopped off, that this is a time to do just that, shut down these companies here?
Well, you'll be happy to know the Hudson Institute has agreed to put out a report in 2 or 3 weeks on the president's tweets and interviews and statements about China and his strategy toward China. It's also going to include all the cabinet secretaries who have spoken out about China. And what I try to do in my selection of these quotations, with links to the original sources, is show just what the president has done so far in the first 3.5 years about China. He draws on some writing he did for 2 books, one in the year 2000 and one in 2015, about how to deal with China. He also seems to have learned a lot from when China reneged in the trade agreement, up to half the provisions, when he instantly slapped tariffs back on. And by the way, he continues 25% tariffs on about $350 billion of Chinese exports to our country. So as he has sought to implement his strategy, he's watching the Chinese reaction and what works, what kind of leverage works. And one thing he's made clear is tariffs work. For whatever reason, whether it's Chinese fears that I've written about or their economic losses, they respond to tariffs. And then he uses the tariff money to subsidize farmers or others who have been harmed by, to some degree by the tariffs. These 20 companies and your letter with Brian Kennedy, you point out another kind of target, if you will, that the president could turn his attention to. Should these companies be assisted in a way that's really unfair to American companies? Is there some means to set back their intellectual property violations, all the things that are in the Phase One trade agreement? I don't know if you read the whole thing. It's 95 pages of legal prose, but there are a number of breakthroughs in that Phase One trade agreement. There's an enforcement system for intellectual property violations where the American company can sue the Chinese company in China for punishment and to cease and desist. If it's not agreed to by the Chinese side, the president's made it clear we pull out of the agreement, and additional punishment then is added. So the value of your letter on these 20 Chinese companies is not only to draw attention to how closely they are involved with the Chinese military, but it's to show the president and his team, here's another area we could look at in terms of getting fair and reciprocal treatment for American companies. These Chinese companies are, in some sense, exploiting advantages that we've given them over the last 20 years.
Among other companies, of course, Michael Pillsbury, it has to be said, the United States government, since at least March of, I believe it is, 2013, thanks to Joe Biden, gave the Chinese preferential access to our capital markets, which these companies are benefiting from, as are others. We are out of time, Michael Pillsbury. I know you've got other things you have to do too, but I do want to say thank you for your work, Michael, and for the chance to visit with you about it. I hope you come back to us and have a further chat about it soon. It's very important that we get this right at this particular moment in time, needless to say. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.